Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm Ankit Panda from New York.
And I'm Zachary Keck from Washington.
On today's podcast, Zach and I are going to turn our attention over to South Asia, specifically discussing the recent political instability in Pakistan and also discussing recent diplomatic developments between India and Pakistan. So as diplomat readers might be aware, Pakistan is currently seeing its biggest political crisis, a crisis in some years. Imran Khan, who's the leader of the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf political party, the party that rules Pakistan's Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province, has marched on Islamabad, the country's capital. He initially pledged to march on Pakistani Independence Day, August 14th, and he delivered. He claimed to march on the capital with a million protesters. He came up far short of that. I believe initially he had around 15 to 20,000 people with him, but that's still a significant amount protesting in the nation's capital. Essentially, his political party and his supporters allege that Nawaz Sharif, the current prime minister of Pakistan, came to power in a corrupt election, and they accuse him of election rigging in the 2013 elections. Now, last year, we all celebrated Pakistan's first historical transition in its 67 years of independence from one civilian government to another. Pakistan has been generally prone to military coups. It has a very powerful military, and we'll discuss the role of the military in all this in just a minute. But Sharif's rise to power was essentially seen as a success for Pakistani civilian democracy. However, all of this is being thrown into question now with Imran Khan's march on the capital. So Zach, do you want to tell us a bit about, you know, where you think the role of the Pakistani military is in all this?
Yeah, Ankit, I mean, I'm not sure it necessarily provoked these crises. It's working with the civilian political parties that are behind this, but I think at the very least, the fact that these parties have Khan has initiated these protests, and that he doesn't seem ready to compromise, suggests that he at least has the tacit backing of the Pakistani military, and that would make sense from the point of, you know, Sharif's kind of been he's kind of challenged military a bit during his time in office, going forward with the Musharraf trial and reaching out to India and stuff. So I think that really, if the military is not actually behind the protests, it's certainly using them to weaken Sharif. What is your view on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some important context here, especially with Nawaz Sharif. I mean, he was overthrown in 1999 when he was prime minister by Musharraf, and that essentially gave him a deep skepticism of the role of the Pakistani military in civilian affairs. And recently, you know, I wrote an article about this, actually. Like, in Pakistan, historically, the position of the chief of army staff has been a really loaded position. I mean, Pervez Musharraf had it. Held that position. Ayub Khan held that position. Zia-ul-Huq held that position. And all of these men were charged with coups and essentially ruling as dictators at one point or another in Pakistani history. The current chief of army staff, from what I understand, seems to be a less ambitious man. He's more of a battlefield tactician who's committed to taking the fight against the Taliban. So that, I think, has led a few people to suggest that this might not be, you know, of the same sort of scenario as it was in 1999 with Sharif especially. Also, I mean, just to put in context Sharif's relationship with the military in Pakistan right now, I mean, yes, it's true that he is skeptical, and yes, it's true that he did upset a significant portion of the Pakistani military's old guard with his decision to bring a treason trial against Musharraf. But the matter remains that in recent days especially, he's been remarkably conciliatory towards the military. He invited them into Islamabad to provide security inside the city, taking that responsibility away from the city's police forces. He praised them in his Independence Day speech. He actually spent quite a lot of time talking about the military's role in Pakistan. So it suggests that he is aware that if he's going to come out of this crisis unscathed, he will need the military on his side.
But that's exactly my point, is now, like, because he's dealing with this crisis, now he's deferring to the military, he's praising the military. I mean, certainly, regardless of whether they had any role in it whatsoever, they certainly seem to be benefiting from it. And also, I think your point about the chief of the army being less ambitious is well noted. But I also think that, I mean, in my view, one of the things that the Pakistan military might be aiming to do is something like the military in Egypt tried to do after Mubarak fell, where basically, like, they let the civilian, and what Turkey's military has kind of done, where they let the civilians sort of run the country, the day-to-day, the domestic stuff, and they kind of, but they have enough power and influence to protect their interests and to you know, veto any foreign and defense policies they don't like. So I think, and this makes more sense from a military standpoint these days, because Pakistan's such a mess that, like, you know, whoever's running the country is not going to be very popular, it seems to me. So I think it would make sense for the Pakistan military to want these civilian politicians out front leading the country and them just making sure that their interests are protected.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a good point. I mean, also, I think the position of the Pakistani military within Pakistani society has kind of been in flux in recent years. I mean, especially since 2011, since the bin Laden raid, I think the military's reputation really took a hit with that, even within Pakistan. I mean, obviously, like, many Pakistanis were upset that the Pakistani military and intelligence services were unable to detect the unilateral American raid on the country. I mean, you look at Imran Khan supporters and his party himself. I mean, you know, one of the major platform points of Tehrik-e-Insaf is essentially Pakistan's national sovereignty should be protected at all costs. And essentially, I mean, this is the same party that was, you know, harassing NATO truck drivers, taking supplies in and out of Afghanistan. It was protesting over U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan regularly. I mean, there's a huge, huge national security undercurrent in Imran Khan's work. I mean, I think that could endear him to the military now, especially. But I think it's important to, like, observe how the Pakistani military's position has changed in recent years.
Yeah, I do think that's a good point. But again, I still think that that kind of goes to the possibility of them just wanting to take a back role, or at least, you know, in publicly taking a more of a back role. But, I mean, I tie this into even, like, what happened with India this week, which you, I think, wrote about already. Maybe we can talk about that, too, because I see the military, again, maybe they didn't do this exactly, but I think that they, you know, because of Sharif's vulnerability, he maybe did it to defer to the military.
Yeah. Just to update listeners on the events between Pakistan and India this week. So Pakistan and India had been making good diplomatic progress. Narendra Modi had invited Nawaz Sharif to attend his inauguration on May 26th, and the two, you know, there was kind of a symbol of the two men handshaking. That was a photograph that kind of got shared around the region. It symbolized that better things were in line for India and Pakistan, which have, you know, they really haven't had any positive diplomatic developments in recent years, particularly since the 2008 Mumbai attacks. But all of that seemed to kind of end very abruptly this week when India canceled scheduled foreign secretary level talks with Pakistan because the Pakistani High Commissioner in India decided to meet with a leader of the Hurriyat Conference in Kashmir, who are a separatist group. Essentially, India's message to Pakistan before this meeting was, you either talk to the separatists in Kashmir or you talk to us. And essentially, when the High Commissioner went against India's warning, the Indian side canceled the diplomatic meeting. And I think, you know, there's been a lot of strange commentary coming out of India on this that I personally disagree with. I mean, I don't know, Zach, I'd love to get your thoughts on this, but, like, one of the arguments that I've been reading a lot in the Indian media is that the Indian government made a mistake by canceling these talks because by doing so, they actually weakened Sharif's hand when it comes to negotiating with more extreme elements in Pakistan that are less interested in having diplomatic talks with India and more interested with sort of, you know, continued aggression across the board and other things. But, you know, I mean, it's kind of a very untenable argument to make that a secondary country should be responsible for the standing of a domestic political political leader in another country. I mean, that's just the way I read it. Like, India should not be responsible for how Nawaz Sharif manages his own affairs in Pakistan.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you on that. But, I mean, I see the other side, too. I mean, this is just a problem with dealing with Pakistan, basically. I mean, this has always been the problem, you know. There's too many – you don't – there's not enough internal cohesion in the country, and it makes their foreign policy – dealing with it on a foreign policy basis is very difficult. So I do think it weakens Sharif, but the problem is that if Sharif already probably gave the go-ahead, at least the High Commissioner, to meet with the separatists, so obviously he didn't have very much sway before. So I just think what's the point of, you know, it's like, you know, trying to – bolster. I mean, I don't know how much, like, still meeting with Sharif would have bolstered, or still meeting with Sharif would have bolstered his political position at home. It probably would have sent the signal to a lot of Pakistani elites that they can get away with doing stuff like that. So, I mean, I think it's probably the right thing to do. I mean, Certainly, if Indian officials met with Baluchi militant separatists, Pakistan would be unhappy, or same with China and Xinjiang. So, you know,
absolutely. I mean, also, I should point out that. But before India canceled the talks, Modi was actually in Kashmir, where he delivered probably his most scathing speech against Pakistan since he was elected prime minister. He essentially called Pakistan weak, and he said that because Pakistan is weak, it resorts to fighting against India using proxy forces and a subconventional warfare, essentially. And I think that the Pakistani response might have been an attempt to punish Modi for those comments on some levels. But I mean, I absolutely agree with you that Pakistan's a difficult country to read and work with diplomatically. I mean, certainly the United States has a wealth of experience in that region. Also, I mean, I should note that I think the best way to describe what you often experience diplomatically with Pakistan is a case of the right and the left hand not really being on the same page. I mean, it can be either the civilian and the military elements of the government, or it can be simply different parts of the civilian administration. It's actually not known to me to what extent Sharif was directly involved. I mean, obviously the High Commissioner answers directly to his government, but it's still unclear the extent to which he acted independently here to meet with the separatist leaders, which is always a possibility.
Sharif didn't bring him back to Islamabad. If he did that meeting without his approval, or you know, it seems like Sharif was mad about it, Sharif would have probably recalled him back to Islamabad. So I think you have to go on the assumption that Sharif sanctioned this either before or after.
Yeah, no, I agree that that's a helpful assumption, definitely here.
I mean, again, this is the point you got to make about Pakistan. That was that was a response to Modi's saying that Pakistan uses proxy warfare. But what kind of response? I mean, that proves Modi's point. He said that the Pakistan uses proxy warfare against us, and they meet with, and the High Commissioner in Delhi meets with militant separatists. Like, I don't know how much that proves their point, or you know, undercuts Modi's argument. I think it probably bolsters it.
Yeah, I mean, also you look at the flip side. I think the Indian response is also interesting because historically, you know, it's maybe difficult to imagine the Congress government under Manmohan Singh reacting in a similar way. I mean, usually there was always an attempt in India for, you know, I hate to use the word appeasement since it's so loaded, but it was sort of similar to appeasing Pakistan in the hope that something would stick when it came to bilateral dialogue. I think we saw that earlier this year when they were having the talks over trade and the most favored nation clause. But I think that's slowly escaping the Indian vocabulary. I mean, it seems that Modi's government is interested in talking to Pakistan on a much stronger footing and demonstrating that there are some clear red lines that Pakistan can't cross if there's going to be dialogue with India.
Yeah, and you know, it didn't seem really like the dialogue didn't get too far under Singh. There were some agreements, but I think there seemed to be limits to this, so I think it makes sense for India to at least try a different approach this time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, all of this, again, you know, brings us back to the Pakistani military, which is, again, going to be very happy with this current state of affairs. I mean, especially given what's happening in Islamabad, given what's happening in Kashmir, I think that, you know, you're right that the Pakistani military is going to benefit greatly from all of this. I don't think we're going to see a coup, but I think we're going to, you know, see some sort of recalibration. I mean, again, it depends on how this crisis in Islamabad resolves itself. I mean, right now there's no dialogue really between Imran Khan and the government. Just yesterday, actually, the Pakistani parliament deemed that it would be unconstitutional for Sharif to resign simply on the basis of protests. So I think there'd actually have to be an investigation into fraud, which I think is highly unlikely, and the government simply wouldn't allow it. So I think that, you know, right now the government's going to ask for Khan to return back to the democratic process in Pakistan, but it remains to be seen what Imran Khan's demands are. Well, I mean, he's already stated his demands, but it remains to be seen if he's willing to moderate them.
Basically. But, I mean, it seems to me that this guy, Khan, from my understanding, doesn't really have the backing of any mainstream political parties in Pakistan. Like you said, the parliament passed a resolution that said that Sharif couldn't resign just from street protests. So, it seems that he has someone's backing if he's continuing to do this. So I think, you know, like you said, there's going to be a recap. This is ultimately the biggest impact. This is going to be that the Pakistan military gains on Sharif.
Yeah, I mean, Khan does have a pretty developed a domestic political base, even if he doesn't have you know, that much of an influence within Pakistani politics in a formal sense. Also, there's the a Canada-based cleric, Tahrir ul Qadri, who's also dispatched his supporters to join Khan on this. I mean, Khan's also, you know, he's somewhat of an Islamist leader in a sense, so he's also rallying those elements of Pakistan's population against Sharif's government. So he's not entirely an isolated individual. He's definitely got you know, a base of political support that I think the Sharif government would do well to take seriously.
Yeah, he doesn't have any. He doesn't have much support within the establishment, like the in the people ruling PacSun right now. The legislature is. That's my understanding. I could be wrong.
Yeah, no.
What is his? He won't negotiate, and so like, I mean, it just seems odd that some guy who doesn't have current any influence really in the government is not going to negotiate. So like, you know, it doesn't make sense really. Like, what he's aiming to get out of this?
Yeah, I mean, what he's aiming to gain is essentially revise the political narrative in Pakistan to acknowledge that Sharif's government is illegitimate, which is a tall order, given that most of the government disagrees with that. I mean, also you have to look at the fact that, like, pretty much Pakistan's allies would hate to see Imran Khan in power, especially the United States and probably even China. I mean, given, you know, Imran Khan's focus on national sovereignty and, you know, disallowing any real action by foreign powers within Pakistani borders, even to attack, you know, extremist elements that are tearing the country apart. I mean, it would really be a nightmare. So I think there's a lot of interest both inside and outside Pakistan that would be absolutely horrified at the prospect of Imran Khan coming to power.
Yeah, essentially this is all taking place at the same time that Afghanistan's having a crisis still. So it just seems like the whole region is kind of falling apart, or at least that part of it.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is definitely I mean, that's why I said that this is, you know, the most significant political crisis in Pakistan in some years. I mean, it definitely has the potential to be. I mean, it could just all fizzle and Khan could go back to Khyber Pakhtunkhwa to lead that region again without any real impact long term, but it also stands to have some major changes in the region.
Yeah, so.
All right, well, thanks for listening to the podcast, and Zach and I will be back next week with more.